Okay, Shambhu Paul is welcome, and everybody right now is on mute. I just would like to give some ground rules. If you'd like to speak, I don't know how many people are going to be, but just to kind of simplify things, if you'd like to speak, hit 5 and then the asterisk sign on your keypad, and you will be connected, or your question will be indicated, and we can answer it that way. Alternatively, depending, as I said, on the number of people who show up, we can have a free-ranging discussion. So it all depends. By way of introduction, I'm Stanley Ginsberg, a.k.a. the Rye Baker, but I'm sure you probably know that. And so if you have a question, hit 5 and then the asterisk, and we will take it from there. First question. Okay, no questions. Let me talk a little bit about the workshop that I did in Portland last week. It was for the Bread Bakers Guild of America. It was a workshop called The World of Rye, and we did 8 breads in 2 days, and it was quite an experience. We ran the gamut. All the breads were from the book, The Rye Baker, and we ran the gamut of breads that were yeast leavened, breads that were sourdough leavened, and breads that had compound sponges, breads that used scalds, bread that used various types of sponge techniques, for instance, the salt sponge, the Monheimer salt sponge, the Berliner quick sponge method, and we used sponges that were type 1, which is acidification and leavening sponges, and we also added these type 2 sponges, which were acidification only. And the difference between those is that a type 1 sponge only ripens for 10 to 12 hours, whereas a type 2 sponge will ripen for anywhere from 18 hours to 3 or 4 days. Okay, I see we have a few more people. Let me just go over the ground rules again. If you have a question, hit 5 and then the asterisk, and we'll take your question. And as I said, if the group remains small, we can open it up to full discussion. But right now, we just kind of keep things. You know what? Never mind. Right now, let's open it up. Hello to everybody. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, who are we talking to here? Who's online?
This is Barb.
Okay.
Dave Nielsen.
Okay.
And David Bond from Chicago.
Ah, okay. Welcome. Let's start with questions. Does anybody have any questions?
I have a question
I have
about...
so many questions.
Okay. Who wants to... Let's see. Barb, why don't you start?
Okay. I just got your book a couple weeks ago. I made my first sponge, and it did grow every day, but it never bubbled.
Well, as long as it grew... In volume, that means that there was going to be some activity. What were you, what temperature were you keeping it at?
The house is 5 at night and probably 69 during the day.
Okay. All right. I mean, you said that it expanded in volume. How much volume did it expand? Did it double in volume, or did it just kind of slightly grow?
Well, it certainly doubled over the week period. I mean, it didn't double every day. You know, every day I started with 70 grams and tossed everything else.
Okay. All right, so how did you feed it? You started with 70 grams. Was this 70 grams total or 70 grams of sour sponge that you then fed again?
I followed your instructions, so I started with 70 grams of water and 70 grams of flour, And then every day I kept 70 grams of the mixture and added 70 water and 70 flour.
Ah. No, you shouldn't have done that. That's the problem there. I see what the problem is. What you need to do is to switch over to 100% flour, 100% water, 10% starter. Because what's happened is that you have basically an overpopulated colony that, and you're not giving them enough nutrients. So if you've got at this point, oh, let's say a couple of 300 grams of starter, which it sounds like, and you're feeding them only 70 grams of flour, you've got a bunch of very, very hungry microorganisms that are competing and aren't going to metabolize the nutrients in the same way that a smaller population would. So I recommend that you switch your feeding regimen from 70 grams of water, 70 grams of flour to the starter you already have to 50 grams of flour, 50 grams of water, and 5 grams of your old starter, and I think you'll find that it will become much more robust, and you'll get a lot more expansion.
So I should just use 5 of the starter that I ended up with this week?
Yeah, because what would, you know, it's, and only feed them once a week or so, once every couple of weeks. They'll last for a long time, as long as you keep it refrigerated. But what we're really talking about here is a colony, a living colony of microorganisms, of wild yeast and of lactic acid bacteria. And, and they need to be fed. And if you've got too large a population and you're not feeding them enough, they're gonna you know, basically compete with the food, eat it right away, and then won't have anything left. And they'll just, a lot of them will die off, but some of them will hang on. So the idea is to use a fairly small, a very small percentage of the starter, your existing starter, to inoculate the nutrient mix. Okay, that will give them enough nutrients to reproduce and to metabolize and to be really active. You know, I know it sounds wasteful, but that's, you know, think of it, you're feeding a pet.
Oh, so, okay, I mean, what I did was what you said to do on page 36 of the Rye Baker, and,
but... Let me take a look at that. Did you say on page 6?
36.
36, okay. Okay, starter day 170-70, new sour refresh, culture from the preceding day, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, so what you need to do is to go over to the maintenance refresh.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, okay. Even though I never got bubbles, you think maybe now I will, or it's just okay anyway?
Well, it should. I mean, as long as it's expanding... put over to the maintenance refresh, to the 70, 70, and 7.
Okay.
How that, if there's a problem, then, you know, get back to me at author@therybaker.com.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I'll keep going with it then.
Okay, good.
I've got a similar question related to the hydration.
Yes.
Which is, I started out using the small amount of starter, and then, like, I use 100 grams of flour and 100 grams of water. I'm just building off of what I do with my wheat flour. But if I just stayed with that, all I ended up, it seemed like it sucked all the water up very quick. The rye sucked up the water quickly, and I ended up with a small rock. So I started adding... like 30, I'm experimenting, so 30 to 40% more water to the mix. And then that works for me. I'm located in Florida, in Orlando, And I'm not sure whether that has anything to do with it. But once I started doing that, everything started working. Do you have any insight?
Well, what kind of flour are you using? Are you using freshly milled or are you using whole grain?
I'm using, for the starter, I've ended up using Hodgkin Mills whole rye flour.
Okay.
The other option that I'm using is a pumpernickel grind that I get from a local artisan baker.
Ah, okay.
First, either way, you know, 120, 130% water to the mix seems to work for me. I don't end up with a Lavon so much as, what's the other, it's more like a Coolish sort of thing, but it works. It's,
so
it's bubbly and...
All right, so it sounds like what you're looking at is something that's fairly loose with the 120
yeah.
or 130. Okay.
Yeah.
First of all, rye is a lot thirstier than wheat. It's much more absorbent. And
right.
so, and especially whole grains tend to be more absorbent than refined flours because of the bran is more absorbent. So rye is going to be a lot more absorbent, and it's going to produce a much stiffer starter dough than,
uh-huh.
than in the same quantities. Normally, when I feed mine at 100% hydration, yeah, it ends up being pretty stiff. But that's okay.
Uh-huh.
I have to stir it pretty well. I wouldn't call it a rock necessarily. Excuse me.
Yeah, it's not quite a rock, but it's close to being doorstop quality.
Yeah, it ends up pretty stiff. It ends up pretty
uh-huh.
stiff. But you know, that proportion has worked for me. If you're more comfortable with 120 or 130% hydration, there's no reason not to do that.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just going by what works.
Sure. Look, I'll tell you what, I mean, what works, you might want to try, do it side by side and see if, do the 100% hydration and do the 120% hydration in side by side containers, and then, you know, give them 8 or 10 hours at room temperature and see which ones, if either of them does any better or if not.
Uh-huh. Because hydration seems to be a key variable for me, even all the way along the line. It's like I've always, you know, I've taken that logic, and it seems to work, except now I'm playing with baking times because of, you know, most of my stuff I kind of have to spoon into pans, but it seems to work better for me down here, and I can't figure out why.
Well,
you know, other than the absorbency of the rye flour.
I couldn't tell you, but you know what? If it works, then by all means do it. There's nothing is carved in stone. I mean, you know, so much
uh-huh,
of it
uh-huh.
depends on, it could depend on the quality of the flour. It could depend on all kinds of
right.
things. So, you know, play with it, and if it works for you, then by all means.
Uh-huh.
Keep on it.
Yeah, it's been my latest discovery and stuff, so I'm kind of working from there. So, okay, thank you very much. I'll leave things open for other people.
You're welcome. Any more questions?
Maybe just
a question about
what? Oops, sorry, go ahead.
I had a question about scalds. You talk about on page 58 about scalds creating high concentrations of natural sugars. Could you expand
yeah.
upon that, and would you also expect the same results if I use scalds in like a normal or a white sourdough with seeds?
Okay. A wheat flour.
Right.
Talking about refined wheat flour?
Right.
Okay. All right. The chemistry behind scalds it's a little complex, but basically you have typically present in the outer layers of a kernel of wheat or rye or whatever, an enzyme complex called alpha amylase and beta amylase. And the role of the amylase enzyme is to convert starches, complex carbohydrates, into simple sugars. And This happens in nature when a seed germinates. And the reason it happens that way is for the embryo to get nourishment, okay? And the embryo doesn't consume the complex carbs. It consumes the simple sugars. And so you have this storehouse of energy, and you have these enzymes that convert those starches into simple foods. What happens when you also have, by the way, in whole grains, you also have wild yeast and lactic acid bacteria present. And the chemistry of scalds involves the temperatures at which each of those three elements survives and prospers. The microorganisms generally have reached their highest activity levels at between 80 and 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And temperatures above 40 degrees Fahrenheit will kill them. The amylase enzymes, on the other hand, reach their peak activity levels at about 140 to 160 or 170 Fahrenheit, and temperatures over about 180 will denature them, that is, will cause them to no longer be active. Now, the whole idea of a scald is to introduce very hot water into a bunch of typically whole grains, and what that does is it kills the microorganisms. And at the same time, it brings the mixture to the temperature range where amylase activity is at its peak. And so what happens is you don't have any yeast or lactic acid bacteria competing to metabolize the sugars that the amylases produce. And instead, what you have is just kind of uninterrupted and unobstructed sugar production by the amylase enzymes. All right, that's the first part of the question. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Does the temperature of the water, is that critical? I mean, if it's 212, you know, boiling water, is that too high? Should it still really be in the range of like 150 to 175? You said here earlier.
No, I normally will bring the water to a boil and then pour it in. And think about it this way: it's going into typically a cold container, into a cold quantity of grain, and it's being poured, okay? And it's not going to be at 210. It might be at 200, and by the time it hits the bowl, it might be at 170, 175.
Okay.
If you're more comfortable with letting it go down, I would say, you know, take it down to about 175.
Okay.
In any case.
That sounds good.
All right. So that's the first part of the question. The second part of your question was about whether it would work as well with refined wheat flours. And that's slightly more complex. And the answer is yes, but only if the flour contains either malted barley flour or a diastatic malt, because refined flours by themselves generally have most of the amylase enzyme carrying layers milled away. And so you can throw the water in, and what that will do is gelatinize the starch, but it won't bring about any amylase activity. So what you would need to do would be to introduce amylases, which is why so many refined wheat flours, if you look at the ingredients, in addition to the enrichments, will also contain malted barley flour.
Yeah, I typically use Central Milling's artisan malted wheat flour, so it would have the malt in it.
Yeah, the malt is there precisely to supply the amylase complex.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any more questions?
Yeah, Stan, this is David in Chicago. I was wondering, of the 8 breads you did in that workshop, did one or two rise to the top as being the, you know, hands-down favorite?
That's not a question that I can answer. I can't speak for the other people who were there. What I can say is that for me, probably my favorite bread of all of them is the Westphalian Pumpernickel. And the reason for that is that it is the bread that showcases the rye and showcases the internal chemistry of the rye as, you know, to the greatest extent. All it contains is water, coarse rye meal, and salt. And it bakes for a very long time, but prior to the bake, there's also a very long scald. And so apropos of the last question, what that scald does is sweetens the dough tremendously, and then the bread is baked for 24 hours at low temperature at 220 degrees, which with the following the addition of more coarse rye meal. And so you've got additional amylase activity, and so you end up, and then caramelization and darkening through the Maillard effect. And so you end up with a very dark loaf that really showcases the inherent sweetness of the rye to the extent that you get it just this incredibly deep, rich kind of molasses and coffee notes in a very, very dense bread. So that's probably, that's one of my favorites. I mean, each one, they were all very different. One of them was an Austrian bread that's in the book called Lifted Loaf, and that's a bread that uses a technique called the Berlin Quick Sponge, which ripens the sponge at about 3.5 hours, as opposed to we overnight. We did a couple of we did some yeast leavened breads. We did one Polish bread that the Polish yogurt rye, which is acidified with yogurt and then leavened with yeast. We did one bread that uses both a scald and a soaker as well as a sponge, and that was the hardy seeded rye. We did some very quick rolls that came together in like an hour and a half, 100% rye rolls. So we really ran the gamut, and I each of those breads, because again, as I think I mentioned, each one illustrated different aspects of rye baking.
I'd love for you to get that show on the road in the Midwest here somewhere. That we talked about that on the last call, but if you can convince the Guild to do an encore presentation of that, it would be awesome.
Well, the Guild is already talking about the possibility of doing an encore presentation, but this one, I'm afraid, will take place in Amarillo, Texas. That was the last I heard, but nothing is carved in stone.
All right. And, well, depending on the time, you know, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it'll be mid-September. And this is not carved in stone. But what was interesting about this, about the workshop in Portland, was that there were people from as far away as Rhode Island and Virginia who flew out to attend. So,
Well, isn't mid-September when Wheatstock is? I hope they're not going to compete with that, right?
The guild would never compete with Wheatstock.
Okay. So I'll figure that out.
Right.
Right.
Let me think. What else? Other thing is, I will be attending the kneading conference in Maine, end of July, doing demonstrations and being there to answer questions and such. So, I don't know if anybody is here from the East Coast.
Where do you find out about these conferences?
Where do I find out about them?
Or is participation limited, or how do you? Like the one in Amarillo, it's not too far from Florida, compared to Portland. But, how do you get on the mailing list or a website?
Well, best thing to do, normally I list my appearances on my website. But as far as the conferences as a whole, I believe the Bread Bakers Guild maintains a pretty complete calendar, both of their own sponsored and other non-sponsored conferences. So,
okay,
if you're not a member of the Guild, probably would not be a bad idea to join. It's about $85 a year, and it's money well spent.
It's not a professional bakers association.
Well, no, it's in fact, I would say probably half of the attendees at the workshop last week were home bakers.
Oh, really? Okay,
and,
good. That's good.
Yeah,
great information.
So we'll attract both. I was talking to somebody, and apparently about 40 or 50% of the membership is home bakers.
Huh.
They have a category when you sign up called Curious Home Baker, so you have to, you know.
Oh, really?
Self-describe.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, self-describe. Yeah.
Yeah. For some reason, I can't find other rye bakers down here in Orlando.
Yeah.
They all seem, I start talking about rye bread, and they all seem to fade off into the woodwork.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, this is.
Well, they're not in Columbus, Ohio either.
Well, this is kind of facetious, but okay, for Columbus, what you might consider doing is going to the University Department of German, and you know, asking around if there are any you know, rye bread fanciers, because the Germans, German expatriates that I've met, also same thing is true of Eastern Europeans. Those are people who complain bitterly about the quality, the miserable quality of the bread here. As far as Orlando is concerned, check out Walt Disney World. There's got to be at Epcot or something. There's got to be some, you know, some German restaurant or some such thing. Oh, I hate to do this. Excuse me. I need to take. No, I don't need to take this. Okay. So I am not taking. I'm not taking this call. All right. Junk call. Anyhow. So those are my thoughts, but quite frankly, at this stage of the game, rye is still in its infancy, even though it's been around for about 40,000 as a food source. Okay, other questions or comments?
I have another question.
Okay,
thanks. I followed your how to make caramel color recipe, which is on page 97, and I followed it exactly, and it turned into hard candy. It did not stay the consistency of honey. I mean, it went right into one chunk of hard candy.
Now, that's interesting, because often what happens in that case is that melted sugar is very weird stuff. Because if you have even the slightest solid crystal of sugar, it will make the stuff lock up totally. I apologize for that, because I know what you went through to clean the pan.
It actually just dissolved.
Oh, did it? Okay.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was no problem.
Ah, okay. Did you save the dissolution? The other thing you might consider doing is adding a bit more water. And I know that when the stuff turns black and you have to add that water, that's really scary. Stuff starts shattering and everything else. You might try adding more. Try doubling the amount of water. Another thing you might consider doing is adding a little bit of honey or corn syrup to the mixture at the beginning, because that will introduce glucose into the mix, and that will interfere with crystallization. Which is something a lot of bakers do, by the way, when they're making simple syrups of sugar and water. You just add a little glucose, whether it's like corn syrup or honey, agave, or anything like that, and that will mess up the ability of the sugar to recrystallize.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right, I will do that.
Good. Next question.
I have a question about the honey flaxseed crisps. I made those the other day, and should they? I think I underbaked them. Or should they be kind of crisp, snappy crisp? some of mine came out a little bit more chewy. They still taste good, but they weren't a real cracker, and I just wondered if I had underbaked them.
Well, generally I bake mine. In fact, we bake them in the workshop also. I bake mine until the edges start turning brown. And the other thing, which did you hang them after you bake them?
No, I did not.
Well, that's probably it, because they come out of the oven fairly flexible, even if you bake them until they start to brown. But the idea then is you need to air dry them for at least 24 hours.
And that crisps them up, and so they really should be snappy crisp?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right, well, I'll change my process then.
Yeah, I think what you need to do is afterwards just let them cool down and then string them on a broomstick between a couple of chairs and let it sit out. Again, though, I mean, Florida being as humid as it is, I don't know what the humidity is like inside your house, but I know my mother...
I live in California.
Oh, okay. All right. Oh, yeah, right. You've got a Bay Area area code.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that shouldn't be a problem.
Okay, thank you.
You're
just
welcome.
A follow-up to that, I made those, and they turned out awesome. And I did hang it up on a broom for 24 hours, and they were crispy. They were like crackers. My wife is, you know, those are the best crackers I ever had. They were really, really, really good. Little sweetness of the honey, there's some yogurt in there, has a little tang, if I recall, and the flax seeds and the sesame seeds. And I think that you got to make sure to roll it out thinly, too. I mean, I think if I recall, the book says an eighth of an inch, but I think I rolled mine out a little bit thinner than that based on the diameter that was written in the book. So, but I do have a question about those, because I think you said that, you know, they pretty much last forever because they're all dried out, you know, so just, you know, wrap them up. And so I did. I started, it makes a lot, and it's just sort of me and my wife eating them. And in addition to all the other bread we make, they didn't get consumed in the first week, let's say. So I said, but no worries, because they last forever, right? So I put them in a Ziploc, and I think after two or three weeks I got some mold. I was like, okay, they don't last forever. So I didn't know if should I put them in the fridge if I wrap them, or should I leave them out? Is there such a thing as a stale cracker? I could leave them hanging on the broom and just pull them down like they do in Finland or whatever when they're ready to eat them. I don't know. What's your take on that?
Well, again, I mean, here's my take on it. I think mold generally happens in an airtight container when there's trapped moisture.
Yeah.
Especially at warmer temperatures. I mean, those, you know, the fungus is always around, and mm-hmm. And they love warm, moist environments. I find my best success with those. Keeping them in an open plastic bag rather than sealed.
Oh, that was it. Yeah.
Yeah. Alternative. You know, I mean, you can hang them up. Certainly, that won't. You know, that won't hurt them.
Won't stale them.
How are you going to stale a cracker?
I don't know. You know, I think you can. I don't know. it just gets a little less delicious, I think. I don't know. I mean, it's not rock hard when it comes out. It's crispy, but it's not. I think there's still some moisture in there, but I don't know.
Yes. You know what? If that's the case, what you do is you're taking a 250-degree oven for 5 minutes and they're back.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, right on. Okay.
Yeah. Or what I do in Florida is I keep everything in the refrigerator, even when it's dry, because the moisture is so high down here.
Yep. Yes, it is. The moisture in the...
Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking about it. I just finished making the rye rusks that you had on the blog site, and it was the same sort of issue. I had them rebaked and everything. Just, you know, using my process that I use for biscotti, it worked out great, except the moisture sucks right back in. So you got I have to keep everything in the freezer and then toast it. And they come out great. Those are the nicest things. They're excellent. So, moisture is a problem.
But one other thing about those is that if you don't fork split them and rebake them, but simply keep them whole and then fork split them and throw them in the toaster, they're a fantastic alternative to English muffins.
Oh, neat idea. Hadn't thought of that. Yeah, they split, fork split very easily and stuff. You know, it was like working with a biscotti sort of thing, and they worked great, idea of keeping them, excellent.
What page are we talking about? What recipe here?
It's called the Rye Refs. It's on the blog site.
Yeah, it's not in the book. It's on the blog.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Tavasti and Rye Refs.
Okay.
Excellent, yeah. Yeah, a couple of those and you're set for the whole day. I've got a question regarding baking. My two most recent breaks were the York Franconia Crusty Bully on page 239 of the Rye Baker, and then Jeffrey Hamill's Old Cornbread in his book. Everything went great. I baked them in 9x5 pans, loaf pans and stuff, and they rose to like within half an inch of the top of the pan on the final ferment. And I put them in the oven at like 400-500 and, you know, with steam, and then dropped that down to about 480 and then dropped it down to, you have, I think, about 380 or something like that, and Jeffrey Hamill had about 382 for the longer part of the baking.
You're talking about the Franconia Crusty Bull now?
Yes, on page 239 of your book.
Right.
And stuff.
Yeah, I have the final temperature at 355.
Yeah. Based on prior experience, you know, when I had followed those temperatures on other things, they came out, they started burning on top before they finished baking inside, so I've dropped the temperature down like 10 to 15 degrees. And that seems to work because then they stay in the oven longer and they bake completely through the bread. What I'm curious about is I lose about half the rise of the loaf. They come out like 2.5-inch high loaves. Is that to be expected, or am I doing something wrong there?
Well, you said you're baking them in pans?
Yes.
Well, this Franconia Crusty Bull is a freestanding loaf. It shouldn't be baked in a pan.
Oh, you can't switch them back and forth?
Well, you can, but it's going to change. It's obviously going to change the baking characteristics. And I mean, as you've discovered, one of the problems that you run into, is that if you've only got a very small percentage of the total dough surface exposed to the heat, direct heat, then yeah, it's going to burn. Because the pan is going to take some of the heat energy away from the side and bottom crusts to heat up the metal of the pan. I have not attempted to bake any of the freestanding loaves in a pan. I mean, certainly you can do it, but you would have to play with the baking times. One other thing that I would certainly do is brush the top with water generously before I put it in the oven.
What would be the result of that, or what would be the outcome? I'm curious.
Well, one of the things it'll do is it'll keep the crust flexible, which should improve the spring. Part of the problem, it seems to me, in losing the spring is that the top crust is hardening, and so it's not going to allow for expansion. And probably my guess is, tell me if I'm wrong, my guess is you probably get blown loaves.
I get what loaves?
Blown loaves, tears. In the loaf.
Not blown in that sense. No, they're just shrunk down in size. It's like they lose like they go into the pans and they weigh like perhaps 30 grams. They come out weighing like 25 to 24 grams. The water content is totally gone.
All right, wait. Are we talking about the loaf now? Because generally,
yeah.
I find that in baking, I lose about between 10% and 15% of dough weight. So losing 5 grams out of a 30 gram object is not out of line.
Okay, because the crumb and everything comes out, pretty nice actually. I've been kind of like totally amazed given my own skills, but okay. So that's right on target. Okay, you answered my question.
Oh, okay.
I'll keep experimenting. Yeah, I'll keep experimenting.
Absolutely. Okay, we've got about another 18 minutes. And does anybody have any more questions?
I've got one. If no one is, this is maybe a little weird, but how do you go about reverse engineering a bread that you like, that you've tasted, and you want to say, "Wow, I want to make that at home," and you're not, Well, you could probably do it, but if you're a serious home baker, what's your approach in terms of advice?
Well, first of all, are we talking about a bread that's made by an artisan baker, or are we talking about a packaged bread or a
artisan,
commercial baker?
For sure.
I'm sorry?
Artisan, for sure.
Okay. Have you considered taking the baker out for a drink and getting him drunk?
Right. Well, I wrote, I don't know if you know Olive and Milo in Santa Monica, but I have their sunflower rye, which is, I just bought it on a lark, it's really, because I'm into rye now. And it's just it was a really great loaf. And so I did, I found their website, and I did info at Olive and Milo, said, "Hey, I really admire you. I'm a member of the BBGA." And I did my thing and tried to say, never heard a word. So I was going to try that one more time maybe. And I was there just on a lark. I'm in Chicago, but I found myself there yesterday, and I should have asked for the baker or asked for somebody to see if I could turn them loose or something. But
absolutely.
They called it. It's probably the best way.
Yeah, what you need to do is to politic the baker. Alternatively, you can. I don't know whether they list ingredients. I believe that by law they need to. And so what you can do is ask them for an ingredient list, knowing that that ingredients generally need to be listed in order of descending quantity. So in fact, if you find that whole wheat flour is listed first, then you know that you've probably got a 50 or 60% wheat bread.
That's a great idea. Because they're selling it from the restaurant, they don't have it listed. Like, you dropped it in a bag and gave it to me. But if I called or emailed and asked for the list of ingredients, I think they'd be obliged to at least tell me that.
Yeah, I think so. I think by law they need to tell you that.
Great idea, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's where I would start. Other things I would think about doing, so I would spend a lot of time dissecting the flavor profile.
Mm-hmm.
And then play with various combinations, various chemistries of scalds and sours and soakers and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
If it's got seeds in it, odds are that the seeds and various other spices will have been soaked. Again, if there are considerable sweet notes in it, then the odds are that there was probably a soaker, a scald rather. The openness and the consistency of the crumb will tell me a great deal. Mm-hmm. It'll tell me about the hydration. It will also give me clues about the relative percentages of wheat and rye. One more thing. Take a slice of bread, leave it out for 2 days, and if you can detect any significant hardening of the crumb, then chances are there is also higher wheat present because wheat continues to stale after baking, but rye doesn't.
Mm. Excellent. Yeah, they call it a sunflower rye, but this last corn, I'm thinking, wow, you know, this is not as rye-y as Stan's bread that I've been baking from that bucket. They call it a rye, but it could very well be like a 50-50 or a 60-40 in favor of wheat. So, and it's a little more open crumb, and it's a little more, I'm going to try the staling slice thing. That's a good idea.
Well, listen, I mean, you know, what they call what passes for rye bread in this country, people are selling bread called rye bread that may contain 10%. You know, I mean, these so-called Jewish deli ryes that are being sold, the mass-produced stuff, the kinds of things, went to a diner or a restaurant and asked for ham and cheese on rye. That stuff may have 10% rye in it and no natural souring at all. They'll probably just add a supplement or start with what in the bakery business is called a base, which is just, you know, add flour and water and you're ready to go. So I think that you know, part of my challenge, as you know, being what I guess a rye missionary, I sort of see myself as Johnny Rye. Is having to counter a lot of the bad rap that rye gets and a lot of the mislabeling. You know, so, all right. So that's a long-winded answer to a very simple question. There we go.
It's a great, there are no simple
questions. Yeah, it's a great idea.
It's a rye, so. Excellent. Thank you, Stan.
Yeah.
Seriously, I would start with chatting up the baker.
For sure. That makes total sense.
Yeah, you know, and if he's not going to give you his formula directly, you know, ask him how he came about developing that bread, whether it's, you know, whether it was originally on a Polish rye, based on a German rye, you know, just get him or her talking.
Excellent. Thank you.
Sure. Anything else?
I've got one, you know, a general background question regarding kneading using my KitchenAid mixer. And this goes back to Peter Reinhardt's, you know, he's got a general caveat in all of his rye recipes to not mix more than 4 minutes because you develop too much, it becomes gummy, he says, which is, and then your directions, your recipes, as well as Jeffrey Hamill's, 10 to 15 minutes, you know, I'm speaking in general terms. Can you speak a little bit to kneading rye doughs?
Sure.
You know, using a KitchenAid on KitchenAid 2.
Sure, because I use a KitchenAid all the time. And with all due respect to Peter, whom I love dearly and deeply respect, he's completely wrong. There's no such thing as over mixing a rye dough, and it's not the duration of the mix that causes gumminess. It's over fermentation and over proofing. When the amylase enzymes run amok and they're not properly controlled by acidifying the dough, the breakdown of the starches into sugars essentially deprives the bread of its structural element, because rye breads are based on these starchy gels, not on gluten. And so as the starches degrade, the ability of a loaf to maintain its structure deteriorates. And so an overproofed loaf will always end up as a gummy doorstop. But I have recipes, for example, I talked before about the Westphalian pumpernickel. That typically will mix for 20 to 30 minutes. And the reason for that is because it contains primarily, exclusively, coarse rye meal. You need that additional mixing to break the meal down and to liberate as much starch from the kernel as possible, because that's what's going to hold the bread together.
Are you talking? When you use a coarse dry meal, are you talking pumpernickel grind or something between that and crack dry?
People talk about pumpernickel rye, and I have no idea what that means. You know, I use coarse rye meal, which is barely cracked grain, for my pumpernickels. Other people may make what is marketed as fine rye meal, but I have no idea what pumpernickel meal is, because it's non-descriptive.
I without showing you the actual, grinds, I'm thinking it's more close to a, it's not fine flour like the whole, the Hodgkin Mills flour. It's a little finer than cracked rye.
All right, medium rye meal.
Yeah, it's probably a medium rye meal. Interesting thing is, I went to my local home brewer store, and they had malted rye, rye berries, and they just throw it through their grinder until I get to the consistency that I want for a fairly low price, 50 cents a pound. So
that's great. Great price.
Yeah. So just a little bit of extra, for malted rye, for malted greens in general. So, thank you.
I'll be candid with you. If I could get malted rye for 50 cents a pound, I would buy up as much as I could. The fact is, it's a lot more expensive than that.
Really?
So
The terminology is really confusing, isn't it? It seems like every miller has a different terminology for what's medium rye or white rye or pumpernickel.
Yeah.
That's a real challenge for us home bakers, trying to figure out what the heck is what.
Exactly.
I can't even find anything called white rye.
Say again?
I can't even find anything in any of the grocery stores even called white rye. Is that similar to cake flour or something?
No, white rye is rye in which from which most of the bran has been sifted out. We sell it. King Arthur sells it, it's often the rye that's used for the Jewish deli rye, and it's used in rye, Polish and Ukrainian rye, some of the southwestern German rye use it as well. So
is it equivalent to an all-purpose wheat flour or a bread flour in terms of?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's different. It's generally white rye is. I have seen only a couple or three breads baked exclusively with white rye. One of them is I have in the book. It's the Minsk rye from Belarus. Most of the time I encounter white rye, it's in combination with wheat flour.
Okay. Yeah.
The Central Milling sells a medium white rye, so I have no clue what that is.
All right, this medium light rye is something that it's the equivalent. The Germans have five or six different varieties of classifications of rye flour. And in fact, talking about that, it's something that I will probably be publishing on the blog within the next few weeks, because a lot of people have asked about rye classifications. But Central Milling's light medium rye, well, let me go back to the German classifications. They start with type 812, and these classifications are based on ash content as opposed to protein content. So the type 812 is the equivalent of American white rye, and it contains about 0.8% ash. And this is at 0% moisture, not at the typically 11 to 12 to 13% moisture that rye flours are tested at. So there's the type A12, there's type 997, which contains about 1% ash. There's type 1150, which contains around 1.15 to 1.2%. Then there's the type 1370, which is the equivalent of medium rye. And then there's 1740, which is whole rye, and it's about 1.8% ash. Central Milling's light medium comes in at about type 1150, which means it's about 1.1 to 1.2% ash, and it's halfway, more or less, between white rye and medium rye.
Okay, well, thanks for the info. I think that write-up would be very interesting to a lot of us.
Yeah. Have I confused you thoroughly?
I wasn't writing the notes down quickly as you spoke, but I think I have a general idea.
I quickly turned to page 29.
Yes, to what you're talking about.
Well,
have you ever
tried that stuff is in the book, okay? And I'm going to I'm looking through it now. But I've got all of the, all of the tables and stuff about the rye equivalents. In fact, if you look on pages 28 and 29.
Okay. All right. Okay, I see that.
Yep, it's all there.
Yep.
It's all there, but the problem is that the U.S. doesn't speak that language. So I took a class, a week-long class with Jeffrey Hamelman, and he was saying, I brought up a little bit, isn't that the role of the BBGA? Like, couldn't someone, and maybe you, Stan, and somebody sort of at the BBGA, that's the industry organization. Like, isn't that the responsibility of those guys to set standards and to try to, put some sort of parameters in place and not to necessarily make it as rigid as Germany and five different classes of rye, but can't we all speak the same language? I mean, there has to be some sort of common language spoken.
Agreed.
Anybody grinds up rye and puts it in a bag, calls it pumpernickel, and you have no idea what that is. So
exactly.
Can we get all the millers on the same page to sort of buy into this? It would be a big, it's a heavy lift, but isn't that what a guild is for,
I don't disagree. I think that what has to happen, but again, what has to happen is for rye to become a significant enough business proposition for these guys so that they would be willing to change in order to get a piece of a growing market. And right now, let's have no illusions about this. Rye is still pretty much an afterthought in the baking world.
Yep.
I think, it's growing in prominence, but it's still an afterthought.
Yep.
Have you had any experience with the Anson Mills rye?
I just recently got some of their, it's the Abruzzi rye, and I just recently got some Abruzzi rye from my friend Nan Kohler, who is at Grist and Toll in Pasadena. And she got it from the Tehachapi Grain Project, which is up in the high desert here, and they apparently got some seed either openly or somehow acquired some Abruzzi seed and managed to localize it to California. So I have some Abruzzi rye. I have not yet played with it, but it's sitting in my refrigerator waiting for my attention. So that's long-winded no.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I had some, and it seemed to work okay, but it's this North Carolina or South Carolina heritage grain, and I called them to try and find out, some information. They grow it, but they don't know any of the technical details of it. I was just curious.
I baked with a couple of heirloom ryes. One, in fact, also from the South Carolina offshore islands, called Seashore Rye. And another one from Oregon called Old World Rye. I don't know what the what the species of the variants are called formally. I found them to be a lot milder and a lot lower in sugar content than the commercial rye I've been using, primarily from Bay State and from General Mills. And I will say the General Mills rye flours are milled by Bay State. So, and they're the largest miller of rye in the country.
Huh. And where, Bay State?
Bay State, yeah. They're headquartered in Massachusetts, but their rye milling facility is, I believe it's up in the Dakotas or in northern Minnesota, but it's somewhere up in the High Plains. And that's where all of their rye is milled.
So if I wanted to find how a given rye flour fits into your chart on page 29, would be my best guess trying to find the ash content. Although yours says 0% moisture, they probably don't even have that ash content at 0% moisture in any of the rye flours in the U.S., would they?
No, but you can, I mean, you know, and this will be the last question because it's after 7. But generally, you can compensate for that. If you know, for instance, what the average moisture content is at which the rye is measured, then it's a matter of simple arithmetic to calculate it. So, for example, let's say you're dealing with a rye that's measured, a domestic rye that's measured at 12% moisture. What you would then do would be to divide the ash content by 0.88, that is 1 minus the moisture content, and that will give you an apples-to-apples comparison.
Okay. Very interesting. This is a great session.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's really good. They're getting better. They're getting better.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, thanks for hosting them, Dan. Very generous of you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, well,
bye-bye.
Let's wrap it up. Good night, and thank you all, and keep your eye on the calendar for the next month's call.
Okay, thank you very much,
Dan.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.